Hey everyone, Jared Borman here. Wanted to make a quick note before we get started with today's episode. The Next Level Learning Podcast now has a website where if you are an educator, administrator, or coach, and you wish to participate in our podcast or nominate someone who can participate in our podcast, then please nominate them at our new website at bit.ly/NLLpodcast. It's a bit.ly, it's a short URL, so it's bit.ly/NLLpodcast. And if you scroll to the bottom, you'll be able to find the nomination form. And please nominate an educator that you feel is deserving of being on the podcast that is doing an awesome job at getting students into those upper levels of learning and thinking. Other than that, enjoy today's episode. You're listening to the Next Level Learning Podcast, part of the Keystone Area Education Agency. Hey everyone, thanks for joining us again for another episode of the Next Level Learning Podcast. I am Jared Borman and I'm here with
Norma Teasy,
the one and only, and we are two instructional technology consultants at Keystone Area Education Agency in Northeast Iowa. And our purpose of this podcast, once again, is to empower educators to move thinking and learning into the upper levels, whether that's utilizing whatever framework you want to use, but essentially getting students to go beyond just that ceiling of applying, you know, like on Bloom's taxonomy. We want to move them to the upper level. So right now we got a pretty cold day outside here in Iowa. I don't know where it is where you are, but Norma's got a nice, I don't know, what do you call that, Norma?
Oh, poncho.
A nice warm poncho. Looks like, yeah. I need to invest in one of those or something, but it's a little chilly outside. But the good news is, we will be able to hopefully put that aside and think about thinking. I mean, Mike Wolfcool, the teacher that I interviewed from Dubuque Senior, really talks a lot about that. And if you are a first-year teacher, if you are a teacher in your 37th year of education, you are going to take something away from this interview, because I know I did, and it was awesome. It was thought-provoking. It was everything you want a good, intelligent conversation to be. He throws out so many resources, does he not, Norma?
I've got a whole list of things to look at afterwards.
I know. You listen back through the clip, and you just got tons and tons of stuff written down that you just want to dig back into. So Mike Wolfcool is a 37-year veteran. He, I believe, is in his 38th year, possibly. He teaches at Dubuque Senior. He teaches high school world AP, a world history AP course, and as well as the non-AP world history course. And he really changed his teaching approach from a more traditional style classroom to something that you would probably label as blended or flipped. Two methods out there now that are becoming a little more popular. They're not necessarily the only method, but they're becoming more popular. And how he talked about that shift early on in his teaching career is pretty fascinating. So let's take a listen to that.
Yeah, well, you know, when I always, you know, you go to workshops and in services, and people always talk about the sage on the stage kind of thing. And I kind of paid attention. I reflect a lot about what I'm doing in my business. And I just watched myself a little bit, and I watched the kids were not engaged, and I was telling them how to think rather than asking them what they think. And this is the time I thought, why put notes on overheads? And I know teachers still do that, and on the chalkboard. I don't ever lecture now. I don't use PowerPoints. We engage back and forth in a collaborative discussion. I try to create a culture of conversation or slash culture of disagreement, depending upon how you want to look at it.
Interesting. Now, you've used the word engage or engagement a few times already. And I think you and I use the word engagement pretty closely, but I hear it used very differently depending on who you talk to. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're really talking about cognitive engagement. Is that right?
Yeah, I want kids always to be thinking about their thinking. When they come into my classroom, they're going to have some preconceived notions about how they think history is developed and what their understanding of it is. And I, first of all, I always operated from a principle of that, what do you think you know, and then go from there. What they think they know is very interesting sometimes. And a lot of times I think we underestimate students that they know a lot more than we think they do, first of all. And second of all, they do have some misconceptions that might need to be rethought through, and maybe they need to look at more diverse information to give them a different outlook. Not necessarily a wrong one or a right one. That's the wonderful thing about teaching social studies, in particular history, is that it changes over time. There's always a different story that comes into play, new artifacts that are dug up. I know I talk to my math and science folks, and they get a little frustrated with the gray area in history and social studies in particular, but I think it's fascinating that they're not necessarily one truth. And I think that's ultimately my goal as we come over the years, is not to produce this good citizenship mentality where everybody goes to the beat of the same drummer, but rather create this active citizen that they think for themselves. So back to your cognitive approach, yeah, thinking is what I want. Critical thinking is what I want. More importantly, I want them to think about their thinking all the time.
So Mike there really talks about the shift from Sage on Stage to something more student-centric. And we hear about these terms in education, don't we, where it's more teacher-centered versus student-centered or Sage on Stage. I mean, there's a lot of different, what are some of the other ones I'm thinking of? Sage on Stage.
Guide on the side.
Guide on versus a guide on the side, yes. So that kind of mentality, basically find two words that rhyme that that fit with what we're trying to describe here. But what I was impressed with in this, what I really like is the definition of engagement that he's trying to establish within his classroom. It seems like he is being explicit with this with his students, where he says, I want them to think about their thinking and everything else. He's basically saying, look, I don't want you just to be looking at me for 40 minutes and have that be my definition of engagement, but I really want you to be thinking in those upper levels for the majority of our class period as often as we can get. If that's every day, that's awesome. But he didn't just get to this. Right. And you heard that, Norma.
Yeah. He did a lot of self-reflection, and we hear that in all the professional literature, that teachers really need to take time to reflect about what they're doing. And I think, you know, he did that early on, it seems like, in his career, which to me is amazing, before we were all thinking about doing it. And I think you mentioned that earlier. And then he's also carrying that in, though, to his students. He's asking his students to think about history, to think about the topic, and that's reflection, too, a lot of that deep thinking. So he's moving it from teacher and student.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because in that reflection process, but you also mentioned, too, Norma, that teachers need that time to reflect, which when you talk to teachers sometimes, they feel like they don't get that time or they don't have that time or they can't find that time and so on and so forth. But we have just heard from a 38-year veteran that reflection part is a key piece to becoming a better learner, whether you're the teacher or the student in the classroom. Just be a learner, and reflection will be a part of that in any step of the process. But I really like how he's established that definition for us moving on throughout the entire podcast, because you'll hear that as a recurring theme from here on out. In fact, in the next part of the interview that we have coming up here, he kind of talks a little bit about the activities that he's set up for his class by utilizing a learning management system and so forth. But it's interesting how he's kind of coordinating these various pieces in order to supplement or at least make the learning process probably more efficient, maybe? I don't know. Let's take a listen and see what he's got to say.
Well, years ago, I took a course through Morningside for some graduate credit, and it was an instructional technology course. And the course was based on the ideas of using learning management systems. And I think I was probably the first one in the Dubuque Community School District to jump on something called Moodle, which was an open source out there that I found interesting. I think the server was out of Kansas City. I used that for many years, and this was a way that I got my students engaged, the anywhere, anytime kind of philosophy. We did all kinds of learning. It didn't always have, the big thing for me is it presented my students with an opportunity come ready to class for discussions. My classroom now can be a troubleshoot, feedback, conversation classroom rather than me shoving things down their throat kind of thing, which, again, I don't get the kind of interesting discussions that I now get because of Moodle. And then the District of Dubuque decided to go to something called Brain Honey, which was through Agilex. We abandoned that shortly, and we went now with Canvas. So all of those learning management systems have given my students an opportunity to mesh with the content that I present with them. So I'll use these as a place to gather content, content beyond what we might use in the classroom. So many of them might use it as enrichment opportunities, became a place for discussion forums. It's a place for them to take quizzes online. And as we take those quizzes online, you know, I had to get past the idea that, well, kids are going to be using their book and therefore they're going to be cheating or whatever that might be. And at the end of the day, I thought, no, this is more like the idea that they're rehashing the content. They're thinking it through and reflecting more on their own. And then the next day we come back, and the interesting thing now with the Canvas we have, it produces quiz statistics that I'm often looking at. When I see a real discrepancy between where I think they should be and where they're not, we have troubleshoot feedback conversations at the beginning of every class. Now, there are times where they do very well with the quizzes and we just keep moving. But our classes are devoted to fix things and to discuss a little deeper ideas of what they have about the content. Usually my classrooms are always started with questions, and they're provocative questions. Either they created them or I created them. And it's all devoted to the fact that they've already done the work before they got to class.
What I heard Mike say is that he's taken these classes, he's read a lot of material, and he's learned about tools that he can use in the classroom. And it's amazing that he's actually been able to learn those tools and put them into practice in his classroom where they fit the best. And I think that's the really strong part of integrating technology as it's best used with students and learning.
Yeah, I would also agree with that as far as the utilization. When you hear some districts now, his particular district isn't one-to-one, but several schools that we do work with are one-to-one, and we hear that it's a costly thing to put that much money into a one-to-one, and depending on how many students you have, that's how many devices, and then the networking and all that stuff, it gets to add up. But he's utilizing that technology not in an electronic homework distribution system. You know what I mean? It's not, here's your electronic worksheet. This gets sent to you electronically. You do the worksheet electronically. You get it back to me. It's not the same learning steps or the same maybe compliance model, if you want to call it that, that's utilizing technology. But he's actually incorporating it in a way where it's almost like, as I really like the quote by Steve Jobs, where the computer is sort of like a bicycle for the brain. It allows us to be more efficient. And this seems like he's using it in a way that makes learning more efficient.
Yeah, and he can use those discussion features that are built into that system he's using for students to be able to discuss at from home, anywhere they want, and to what depth they want. And to me, that's really powerful. Not to wait for class to do that, but actually be able to do it in that system.
Yeah, and most households now, not all, but still most households now have some kind of internet capability. Yeah. So connecting to that learning management system outside of classroom time, that's a huge shift in thinking, where a traditional setting is I have these students for 45 minutes versus I have these students more than 45 minutes now, and I don't want to waste their time with a bunch of lower level thinking, but I want the lower level thinking to supplement the upper level thinking that we can now do in class, right? So it's just interesting to hear him point all that stuff out and utilizing those tools in that fashion. And again, in a way that is probably a little ahead of the curve. I mean, you don't hear too many teachers around here 10 years ago doing this. So that shift was really important for him. The questions. It seems like his whole classroom is centered around the idea of asking questions. And he even said, the questions either come from me or they come from the students, which I thought was really interesting, because now you have students that are creating questions for discussion, but let's be real here. Some students are probably going to ask superficial questions. So you almost have to teach students how to ask questions, right? Do you have any experience with, like, the questioning process or anything?
And that tells me that the students have been thinking about that at home.
Right.
Outside of the regular classroom, which is the really cool part for me.
To have them thinking about your content outside your 45 minutes, that's cool. That's a lot of fun. So let's take a listen here for a second as far as how he gets students to ask good questions.
Well, early in the year, they want to start their questions usually with the what and the who kind of questions. And like, who was Columbus? You know, that could be actually a bigger question if you think about it. But at the end of the day, I teach them a technique I learned from a Dan Rothstein, who wrote a book about question focus technique. I don't know if you've ever heard of it before, but I just simply acronym it as QFT. So this actually came to me as the C3 framework. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all. It was being rolled out. The C3 framework, which is the social studies framework of where we're going. And one of the domains or dimensions in the C3 framework is compelling and supporting questions. And in there, it recommends that not only do you have teachers develop strong skills at that, but also students should develop those skills. So ever since I went to the NCSS conference, the National Council for Social Studies in St. Louis a few years ago, I've been doing more and more of teaching my students at all levels, AP and my regular world history kids, how to prepare their own questions. It's very encouraging for me that where they were at the beginning of the year, their questions are so engaging now. They're writing better questions than I am now. You know, sometimes I have to build them up, prop them up, tweak them a little bit here and there. But all those are, again, troubleshoot feedback opportunities where I'm teaching them to write better questions. I tell them that wherever you go, again, I want you to be an informed, active citizen, and that one way to do that is to be a good question maker. And, you know, as we went through like the political campaigns here in the past year, one of the things I encourage them to do is understand it's your job as a citizen to be informed and ask good questions and get the answers you're looking for in this world. So they're getting much better at it. But it always leads to our discussions, and they're more invested when it's their own.
Yeah. The thing I heard in that clip there was, I think the thing that surprised me the most was the students are starting to ask better questions than what he feels he could probably ask, which again just shows that if you assume that the students in your classroom are simply there to be filled with knowledge, then that's essentially what you're going to get. But in Mike's case, he's having students walk into his classroom, seeing them in a way where, how can I get them to ignite their own thinking? And the best way to do that is questions. Simple as that. Because questions spark curiosity, which is that natural energy within all of us, which has existed over eons.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jared. Students are capable of deep thinking and coming up with questions, but we have to encourage that and get that going.
Yeah,
and that's our job as a teacher.
And don't you feel like sometimes, too, in our current role as instructional technology consultants, that we even do that with teachers now, too? I mean, I can just think of several examples where when you work either one-on-one with a teacher or in a small group, just to prompt each other's thinking, it's always best to just ask. I actually see my job as just a question asker. That's what I really try to do more than anything else. Not feed people information, but just ask questions so that they can develop their own answers.
And they can come up with that, do their own reflection and start that.
It's something that I actually try to do at home with my own kids. It's hard, you know, with three small kids and they're just asking a bunch of questions.
Well, sure.
And so you're encouraged to just answer. But it's okay to answer a question with a question in some fashion. So that way you can get them to be self-thinkers and self-reflectors. It's not easy, but I imagine maybe it's a little better at the high school level. But either way, I think that's just something that's part of the human process and experience, maybe. Mike also talks a lot about the lower levels and upper levels. And as you know, this podcast is all about how do we go from the lower levels to the upper levels. And of course, we're talking about like going from lower level Bloom's taxonomy to upper level Bloom's taxonomy, or going from levels 1 and 2 on the Webb's DOK, depth of knowledge, up to 3 and 4. Whatever that is, we want to get to those upper levels and be there as frequently as possible. Well, it was interesting to hear Mike do this utilizing that learning management system, as we listened to before, by pushing out those lower level things. You know, students can do these lower level things. Let's push them outside the classroom. But now we have the opportunity to do activities in the classroom that build upon the upper levels of thinking. So let's take a listen to see what strategies and examples he gives.
I think it's been within 10 years I've been on the learning management system. You know, we've all taken online learning courses somewhere along the road, and we've seen the blackboards and the different opportunities are out there. And I was just excited to get into my own. And I remember when I first got into the learning management system called Moodle, is that I actually watched it all the time. I'm trying to see how the students are engaging with it. Probably the one most powerful thing that I've done, especially for those students who are not really good at culture of conversation and not real comfortable with the culture of disagreement, is discussion forums. And I'm still teaching them how to get there. I remember I'm dealing with sophomores in high school, teaching them the idea to create a post that's supported by evidence, a post that explains their evidence, and threading to other posts and contradicting those posts and with evidence again. You know, not just the idea of I've even seen at the college level online learning. I agree with your claim. You have a good idea. Well, that doesn't say anything. I want them to take a step further where they're going back and forth in that safe zone of a discussion forum. So when they get to the classroom, I find that over the year, those students who are a little more quiet early on will grow in their conversation because they found in the safe zone they can do things out there and they didn't get attacked for it or anything of that sort. They come to the classroom, they could play a little more seriously.
So Mike talks there a lot about the use of discussion forums specifically. And I think this is kind of an important thing to note, which is why I really feel like it's important to include its own little clip. I get a lot of questions. So in my personal experience, myself, Bev Burns, and Melissa Wicklin, we co-created a blend flip learning cohort. And part of that is the discussion of a learning management system and how to push those lower levels out onto that learning management system. But we get a lot of questions about, well, which learning management system is the best and everything like that. And I don't think I could flat out say, gotta go with this one. But one key feature that I do look for in a learning management system is the use of discussion forums. Is it there? Is it usable? How usable is it for the students? It's a powerful, powerful tool to even get students into some upper level thinking in that online learning environment as well. And you've experienced this too a little bit, Norma, as a student, as an adult learner, with the use of discussion forums and its a power to have that facilitate the thinking.
Yes, I think it's a really powerful tool. One of the classes that I took required us to contribute to that discussion board quite frequently. And at first, you know, it was a little scary, but after you've done it a few times, I really liked it. It brings that student who maybe has to think or ponder the question a little bit more before they respond. It gives them that time to do that. I can look up research to support what I say. It just gives me more time to think about what I'm wanting to present to my colleagues.
It almost kind of primes the pump for thinking. So it's a preliminary way to start some thinking going and some reflecting, which then can, and how Mike is using it too, which then carries over into the large group discussion mm-hmm. when they come back for class, right?
Right.
And so did you come back to a large group in that case?
No, we didn't. This was a distance learning class, totally distant. Okay. But everything was done, you know, online and mm-hmm. in that discussion group. But we could always go back to other threads, and we did that a lot.
Yeah.
People would come in whenever they had time, and then whenever they found another piece of research that supported something. So we were continually going back and forth, and I thought that was, for me, really, it was learning because I learned a lot from everybody else, and it wasn't threatening.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I get questions from teachers, and maybe you get the questions too, Norma, I'm not sure, but when I get the questions from teachers saying, is this a good learning management system? Is that a good learning one? I always look for the discussion mm-hmm. thread. Is there a good discussion forum? And so there are some tools out there. Like I know Google Classroom is a very popular tool with teachers. There really hasn't been built in yet a solid discussion forum, which has always made me kind of leery of it, I'll be honest, or even the use of Edmodo. I used Edmodo early on in my own blending and flipping experience, but the problem for me was the discussion threads. And there is sort of a discussion thread now built in. But then again, the homepage is just a feed. It's like a Facebook feed. So you got to scroll through to find things. And that's not conducive to a learning environment. So there are certain features that do play a big part in all of that. what I really like him talking and explaining is I've used the learning management system as a way to prime our thinking and our discussions. And he also addresses a lot of in-class time. Now, I say this is probably the one area with blended and flipped learning where teachers will literally make or break the experience for themselves. If I push lower levels out and all we do in class then is more lower level work, it's going to fail. It's not going to be effective. Whereas what Mike is doing in this case is he's pushing lower levels out, but he's building in more upper level activities. And so some of those activities are kind of important. And I wanted to highlight that because I wanted to see what he was doing at that in-class time, because those are the examples that I then also want to push out to other teachers that ask those kind of questions as well. So let's take a listen to Mike's in-class activities.
You know, I look at the Iowa Core a lot, and I look at the C3 framework, and I look at those. I'm kind of categorical about the way I think. First of all, there's the speaking and listening piece. And that actually is my teacher goal for the year. Is I want my students to be more of a conversationalist and more substantive conversations. So that's my goal. Well, but I think there's a lot of underlying things below that. One of them is reading informational text. One of them is writing. There's a lot of things that they can do beyond that. I work on soft skills like learning skills and work habits. So for example, in my regular world history this week, we're doing a writing task online where students will be doing what is called a raft. I don't know if you've ever heard of it before. It's a role writing thing. It's a role audience format topic. And with that, they also, again, go back to practicing, stating a claim, giving their evidence, explaining how that all works. Well, we do that on campus, on learning management system. So they will write. So this past one, they would be a peasant in France, and they would deal with the idea of how they would felt like living in France at the time Louis XIV was a ruler. So it makes it relevant to them too, because it makes it relevant from the standpoint of how would they like to have lived under that kind of leadership. And that kind of leadership exists around our world today. So it's just also making that awareness there. But they'll write that. And we just wrote that for more of a formative type thing. We'll do a couple more down the road here before we get to a summative one. But then they'll get used to the criteria, and they'll, after they write theirs online, then they'll score each other. They do a criteria scoring thing of historical accuracy, format, point of view, audience, and I'm forgetting one of them. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but they do all these types of skills with RAFs. We do a lot of writing online. I don't just use my LMS. I also use 365, Office 365, where we do OneNote work. A lot of back channeling where I can see kids write, they can see each other write. We can look at samples there. There's all kinds of things that they do. You know, we don't live on the computer. I just see the computer as a tool to engage my students. I mean, I can engage them on paper and pencil. I can engage them on the whiteboard. They love to go to the whiteboard. There's just so many things that we can do. A lot of times I'll put recent work, and I just, that's my regular world history, that put the rafts, I'll put them up on the whiteboard, and I'll say what's good about this, what's not good about this. We'll underline things, circle things, they'll point it out, I'll point it out. They get better at the criteria, they get better at writing. So I mean, all these things I think are threaded together to making them better as an active citizen.
What I heard in that segment is I was impressed by how much writing is used in the social studies classroom. They project their writing on the smart board, and students assess or look at each other's writing and evaluate it based on some criteria, which is really, to me, higher level thinking.
Well, yeah, right. It's analyzing, it's evaluating, right? I mean, when you're looking at not just your own work in a way, but other students' work for good examples, bad examples, that's really important. That's a comparison contrast strategy. And as you said, just strengthens the writing as a whole.
Right, and I think it encourages students to reflect on their own writing when they see what their classmates are doing.
So there are two things that I want to add here. The first one is piggybacking off exactly what you said. So the students are being reflective, the teacher's being reflective. Now, there's a term that's basically used throughout of education right now, and that's growth mindset. And a part of growth mindset is the idea that I can get better at anything, but first I have to identify what it is I'm not good at, right? And so he did that early on in his teaching career, and it has led to this. Now he's trying to get students to analyze and evaluate what is it that I'm not good at, and then begin to work towards how can I make it better, and specifically with writing, but then also through the use of discussions that also prompts the writing and pieces together those ideas. But this was actually interesting because this was he's in a social studies environment, and I vividly remember during my master's work where I was doing a literature review on flipped learning, and one of the studies that I read was a social studies classroom, but it was in an undergraduate level classroom, okay? So the one thing that I remember was this particular teacher, and I can't remember the date, if it was 2010 or so, but essentially the teacher used blended and flipped learning strategies to push lower levels out, and what he wanted, his main goal for flipping, was to build more writing time. And so what he found was that students had a lot more time to write, they had a lot more time to think, and they had a lot more time to peer review each other's work. And he said by the end, the work he got was by far better than what he'd ever gotten in the past. And not only that, the students' qualitative data that came back basically concluded that they felt they were able to provide better quality work because they had more time to be able to peer review and evaluate and analyze. So proof that if you build that time in, now sometimes we expect students to do this outside of class time, but if we build that time in class, now we can actually get more or get better results from what we were hoping to get in the first place.
Sure, move those lower level things out to the homework or to the back or to later and really bring that higher level thinking in. And I think that's really important, giving students time to do that and develop that.
And that's not like we're saying if you blend and flip your classroom, you're going to get the same exact results. It's kind of like saying project-based learning is going to save your learning problems or teaching problems and this system or that system. It's a matter of, and you can even hear Mike, over the course of years, through his learnings and his readings and everything else, he's taken the best stuff and he's pieced together something that's worked for him and his learners. It's not really one system of learning and teaching. It's a combination of several, probably, in most cases. Now, I did ask Mike, because we do talk a little bit on here as far as Bloom's or DOK or something else, and so I posed that question to Mike as far as what does he exactly use? Because when he's planning these highly engaging lessons, cognitively engaging lessons, how does one go about doing that? I mean, does he just naturally do it, or is it because he's been in the game for so long that he just does it so easily? What does he exactly use to formulate and design some of these lessons? Let's take a look at that.
You know, I'm familiar with all the Blooms and the DOK and all of those things. I think the real guiding thing for me in the last few years has been a piece I read. I can't remember even where I read it, but it was about history being a very unnatural act and the study of unnatural act. Sam Weinberg actually writes a book on that. He calls it History, the Study of Unnatural Acts. But I've come across, I can't remember, Donovan and Bradford, I think, were the authors, and it talks about how students learn history. And it's such a unique and different thing. Whereas when you find others' course areas, there's usually a right or wrong answer. And as I said earlier, this is a kind of a gray area. And students come to with these things with misconceptions and preconceptions, et cetera. And there's no really one single truth to it. I think that's really what guides me to everything I do. I've taken so many things and I've tried to pull them together. There's always that one principle that we are such a unique subject and we have an obligation to our young people prepare them to be active citizens. You know, the C3 framework is about college and career ready. And then the one that everybody forgets about is the active citizenship. And I think that's a weakness in our country right now. As witnessed by, you know, the recent political campaigns, I think people get caught up in all of the sensationalism rather than, let me think this through. What's the truth that's out there? So, you know, all of those things you're talking about, you know, thinking, evaluating, analyzing, all those high level thinking skills all come into play there if you're creating active citizens, I believe.
Mike mentioned the C3, getting students ready for college and career readiness. And I think the course that he's teaching, the content that he's using, the strategies that he's using, all lead up to helping kids become those better citizens and directly addressing the C3. Because he's having them evaluate, analyze, they're evaluating the content, they're coming up with their own questions, they're analyzing their work, their students' work. That is what we do every day in life. And so he's really building all those skills up. Earlier, I think he mentioned textbooks. This was a prime opportunity to bring in primary sources, because when you look at a regular basic document, you've got to think, well, how does this fit in? What is it truth? What does it really mean? And so a great opportunity to bring in those primary sources.
Well, and as the media collection kind of specialist, you know, Norma, you, for our AEA, we have tons of primary sources at every grade level that could be brought in to, I don't know if you want to call it supplement the textbook, because then that kind of puts focus as the textbook as the main resource too much. I personally don't like to put that much emphasis on the textbook. I just see the textbook as another resource, just like any other primary resource, but it's a matter of bringing them all together in some fashion. But how have you seen these primary sources go out and everything else?
One of the sets that come to mind right away are, we have the Jackdaw posters, and there are photographs, collections of photographs of different time periods and events that have happened in history. And there's a teaching guide that goes along with it too. But that, it would be collections of photographs that you can evaluate and draw your own conclusions from by looking at the real document.
So you by automatically bringing in those pictures, you're building in an activity for analyzing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to bring the students right into those upper levels right away. Absolutely.
And of course, the Library of Congress has a lot of the same thing. The National Archives, lots of universities have a lot of primary sources. So there's a lot of opportunity for going online for those too.
Yep. I just want to go back to the Blooms and the DOK thing, because those are the two kind of frameworks that we see being used most often in promoting lesson design. You know, so creating lessons for this kind of thinking is not easy, because it seems so organic, where you're bouncing ideas off of one another. But it was interesting to hear him say that, yeah, I'm familiar with those, but it's not really the main thing that has influenced the design or the thinking that goes behind the designing of my lessons. By referencing that one piece of reading, and that basically talks about how we think as learners within a social studies context, which I think was really important, because you're taking into consideration your content, sure, but you're also taking into consideration the learning process within that content, so the pedagogy that fits with the content in order to maximize the learning as much as possible for that. I mean, I remember every teacher who's graduated from college with a teaching degree, I imagine, at least in the state of Iowa, probably everywhere else too, you're going to be introduced to Bloom's Taxonomy. You're probably going to be introduced to Webb's Depth of Knowledge, the DOK. You're going to be introduced to all of those. But how in-depth do we really go in some of the teacher prep programs with those kind of learnings, and then say, okay, if you want to utilize this as your framework, how do we embed that and create lessons that mesh with that? I personally don't remember lessons on that.
What I've been thinking about as I listened to Mike is, he talked about what is the truth and getting at the truth. When you think about that, that is really deep thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It not only on the student's part, but also the teachers have to figure out, how am I going to get at that? And I've been thinking about that through this whole interview, and I'm thinking, what is the truth? That, to me, that is really challenging. And then I think, too, he mentioned that there's no gray area. So when he's designing these lesson plans, I think teachers have to be flexible. I'm sure he probably is, based on the student questions.
So, yeah.
And
I mean,
what they're interested in.
So the lesson design isn't going to be step-by-step objectives here in this case. It's going to be, I honestly felt that way when I started to blend and flip my own classroom, is I felt like I had a good general idea sort of in place. But if I felt at any point in my lesson plan that we ended up going in another direction, I felt okay with that. And it sounds like he's very comfortable with that. In fact, he encourages that and enjoys that moment within the teaching environment. I don't know. That's exciting for me. I think that's energizing as an educator, right? It's a lot of fun.
And I think Mike mentioned somewhere, too, that you have to know the content. And I think to do this, you really have to know the social studies content.
Yeah.
And I'm sure most social studies teachers probably do. But
yeah,
you do have to know your content to be able to do this.
There's the TPAC framework out there, if you're familiar with it, where it basically looks at the three areas of knowledge of an educator. You got the content knowledge, you got the pedagogical knowledge, and then you got the technology knowledge. Now, it started off as just content and pedagogy, but now that we're in a much more learning, a modern learning environment where we have the technology that can make learning more efficient, you have that technology piece. But I'll be honest with you, in my college prep courses, it was very heavy content. Yeah, there was pedagogy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was more than one course on pedagogy. And then there was that one mandatory class you had to take that was technology.
That's what it was for me too.
Yeah. So I run into teachers that say, I know my content. I'm good with that. It's the pedagogy that I could still beef up. And then some teachers that say, the technology part is beyond me. So it's at nobody's fault. It's not like you're born with this knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is knowledge that we have to acquire, not just in college, but continuously. And that Mike is proof that he has just continually acquired this knowledge. And then he just wasn't born with it or received it all in the college prep courses. It's something over the course of 38 years that has culminated into this very robust and cognitively engaging learning environment. So the interesting part, though, is when you say this is a really cool environment to learn in, how do you go about assessing it? That's a tricky question. And that's a question I get, at least. I don't know if you get it, Norma, at all, but it's a tough question. And so I pose the question to Mike. I say, what about these teachers that might say, Mike, what you're doing is awesome, and I want to do that too. But how do I assess that? Let's take a look and see what Mike had to say.
Well, I mean, there is certain facts out that are facts. And when students start to move away from the credible facts that are out there, then they're no longer supporting a claim or truth. When their evidence is not accurate, that's a big issue. Matter of fact, that's interesting you ask that, because in our PLC at Senior right now, that is what we're talking about, is what is quality evidence? What is the accurate evidence out there that one needs to bring? And that's why it's, to some degree, it's part, I think, what makes me a professional and makes me an expert in my field, and not everybody can teach social studies, I think, is the idea that I know what materials and what content to bring to their attention. I'm not going to bring in certain things out there. I'm going to bring into, 5-10 different things. It's my job to supplement the textbook. The textbook is very vanilla. It is, as I tell them early on in the year, there's a good video out there, if anybody's ever looking for it, it's called A Danger of a Single Story. It's written by a Nigerian novelist. Her name is Chimamanda Adichie, and she talks about the idea that, if we have one story, then we ignore all of the other truths that might be out there and all the other facts that are out there. If I was, start out my career again, I'm working with a lot of young staff. It's a real scary thing to come into a classroom and thinking that you're teaching from a gray area subject, because the easy thing to do is there's black and white, like the textbook would like you to believe. The scary thing is that kids might ask questions. The scary thing is kids might get you going in direction and discussion that you didn't plan on. Every discussion I have every day is different. Every single one. Kids ask me, says, how do you keep doing this after 37 years? I says, because every class period is different than the previous one. Different classes write different questions. Different classes bring up different things in the discussion. It's all interesting. So to me, that gray area is where it's all at. And I think that's what makes it all interesting. And if I was to start over again, like the young pups that are in my department are all doing, I think I would encourage this. Let them do the learning. I keep telling them, the young ones I work with, I mentor a lot, it's just engage them. It's not what you think, it's what they think. And then you can talk to them about whether they're way off track or not. Yeah, there are some things that aren't always true. It depends on the facts you bring to the truth.
So I don't know if Mike directly or explicitly answered the question in that part, in that clip there, as far as, because that is the question that I often get from teachers, is, look, I want to do this blend flip stuff. I want to do this project-based learning stuff. I want to do all of that. I want my classroom to be like that. But the one thing that keeps holding me back from doing that is, how do I properly and effectively assess that kind of learning in that environment? So it becomes very difficult, but I think you kind of alluded it to early in the podcast here. You got something there, Norma?
Sure. Mike talked about that he has a lot of formative assessment in his classroom, and that eventually he moves to summative. And he talked about the RAFT writing project that I think that we alluded to earlier too, and that the students score each other, and that he has a set of criteria. I remember one was historical accuracy, and then he listed a couple others, I think, too. So it sounds like he does have a rubric or some kind of criteria, and they all know what it is. And then they need to know that this is what the expectations are.
Well, and it sounds like, you know, coming from an English teaching background, it's kind of like what I try to do too, is even if you have a piece of writing, is there going to be a right or wrong answer? Is this a test that you could do in a, say, bubble type of fashion where they fill things in? Possibly. But really, how do you assess upper-level thinking? Well, can students effectively and properly defend their conclusions? So when they are trying to answer a big question or come to some kind of big conclusion, after they do some analyzing, evaluating, and so forth, the thing that they're then creating, that upper level of Bloom's, is going to be that piece of writing. And in that creation process, can you properly defend your conclusion? Most likely with textual evidence, pulling maybe even some other resources that weren't used in class.
Primary sources.
Some other primary sources that the teacher didn't have available for you, other pieces of evidence, mm-hmm. maybe from your own personal experience and mm-hmm. so forth. I mean, there's all kinds of options here, but then it's going to be a matter of then, yeah, that's sort of more gray as to how do I assess that, but he does have that rubric there along the way to sort of help the students understand, here's how you sort of organize your thinking, which in all aspects of writing in the Common Core or Iowa Core or whatever core you want to look at, that's a common theme amongst mm-hmm. a lot of grade levels and almost a lot of different contents. So it's hitting a big area in that way. We want to thank Mike once again, Mike Wolfcool from Dubuque Senior. We got some, like we said, mentioned before, the primary sources Norma mentioned in our library.
Just a reminder that Keystone's media collection has a lot of primary sources. So do a search in our media catalog and you'll find all kinds.
And he also mentioned too that always, no matter where you are in your teaching career, continue to learn, continue to try to get better at your profession. There's no better way to do that in a face-to-face environment than our Keystone Premier Education Conference. Those dates are lined up for June 20th and 21st. All information as far as our keynoters, our featured speakers. Be sure to take a lot of information on our Keystone AEA website. Otherwise, I've enjoyed this conversation, Norma, as always. So thanks for joining me and thanks for listening in.
It's been good learning for me, too. I've got some resources I'm going to check up on now.
We will see you next time.
The Keystone AEA proudly supports the Next Level Learning Podcast.